Good morning again. Open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 12, please. And we'll begin our lesson there. Hebrews chapter 12. We're glad you're here. Thank you for coming. We have visitors with us again, and we appreciate everybody's presence and your interest in spiritual things. I want to start here in Hebrews 12. Let's start in verse 4. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as to sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which you have all become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Okay, clearly we have a passage about the discipline of the Lord here in Hebrews chapter 12. The question is, what is that? What discipline? What's he talking about here, and what does that mean to us? First of all, is Hebrews 12 saying that when we sin, God punishes us immediately on earth? In other words, if I'm diagnosed with a disease, does that mean that's God punishing me for something I've done? If my house burns down, is that because God's punishing me for something I've done? Look in Job chapter 1, please. I think we have to be really careful about making that connection. The Bible certainly acknowledges that there have been plenty of times when God has done that very thing. He struck people for some sin that they've committed. When Miriam rebelled against Moses, God struck her with leprosy. Numbers 12 and verse 10. In the New Testament, when Herod was overcome with pride, an angel of the Lord struck him and he died. Acts 12 and verse 23. So we can find examples that show God striking somebody for sin. But there were other times when bad things happened to somebody and it was not punishment for sin. And Job is an example of that. Job chapter 1 and verse 8. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, for there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. So God is not pointing to Job and saying, now here's a sinner, here's somebody I want to punish. He's saying, look, here's an example of somebody who's good. He's blameless, he's upright. And yet God allows Satan to attack Job. Verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him. So the Lord departed from the presence of the Lord. And the torture began. God himself commends Job, but he allowed Satan to torment him. Look also in the Gospel of John, please. John chapter 9. And in the Bible class, we mentioned this chapter and the man who was born blind. Let's read those three verses at the beginning of the chapter. John 9 and verse 1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Jesus answered, it was neither this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And then Jesus goes on to heal this blind man. So here's another example of where it had nothing to do with sin. That's what the disciples assumed. This guy must have sinned, or maybe his parents sinned, and as a punishment, he was born blind. But Jesus said, no, that wasn't it. Appreciate Adam reading for us from Luke 13. The same thing there, I think, in that passage where two examples are given of tragedies that happened in this world, and that's all there was to it. It was just tragedies that happened, and it was not punishment for sin. It was not God directly punishing people for sin. In fact, sometimes people endured hardships not because they sinned, but because they were righteous. Jesus, of course, is a perfect example there. Jesus was crucified. That was not punishment for sin. He was doing all the right things. He was the only one that lived on earth who never sinned, and yet he was murdered. Paul wrote, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12. So when you get persecuted, that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, that's God punishing me for sin. It might be the opposite. It might be because of my righteousness, Satan is after me. He's tormenting me and he's persecuting me, just like Paul foretold. And so given those kinds of verses, I think we need to be very hesitant to conclude that when something bad happens in my life, I befall some tragedy, whatever a bad thing happens in my life, God is punishing me for some sin. There's just too many verses that show other interpretations of that. So what is the discipline of Hebrews chapter 12? What is this talking about? Perhaps it's talking about, and I think it does include, this letter itself, the book of Hebrews itself, this letter, this epistle of Hebrews. And that view, I think, certainly has merit. It's written to people who are in danger of falling away. It's written to them in part as a rebuke, in part as encouragement to them to try to shore up their faith and to bring them back. Go back to the book again, please. Hebrews, this time look in chapter 13. Here at the end of the letter, Paul, or whoever's writing this by inspiration, is making the points here that, look, I want you to understand, this is being written to you to help you. This is a loving father. He's writing. He's trying to bring you back. He cares about your soul. I know this letter's been tough to read, but remember, God's a loving father. And this is a letter of rebuke and discipline and warning, but it's been for your own good. And in Hebrews 13 and verse 22, I think is another phrase that just kind of goes along with that theme. Hebrews 13, 22 says, "But I urge you, brethren, bear with this word of exhortation, for I've written to you briefly." In other words, look, it's a tough letter. I get it. But this is God exhorting you. He's trying to help you. He's trying to bring you back into the fold. But even if Hebrews 12 and the discipline passage that we're talking about is referring to this letter itself, the book of Hebrews itself, I'm not sure it would exclude something else. I think there's something else also involved in that. Consider the possibility that the discipline includes the trials of life that God allows people to undergo. The trials of life that God allows His people to undergo. And this letter explains that discipline and helps people understand that discipline. And the letter itself includes some discipline. But the hardships were already happening to Christians, and one function of this letter was to help them have the right attitude about those hardships, to kind of frame that in their mind in the correct way and understand what was going on. Specifically, I think Hebrews 12 is saying, don't think that God has abandoned you. When you endure hard things, when you're persecuted, or when something bad happens in your life, don't think, well, where's God? You know, God's abandoned me. Don't think that. And he's telling them in Hebrews 12, this is a loving God. And just like a loving father disciplines his children, you got a loving father in heaven who is disciplining you in that way. He has not abandoned you. It's just the opposite of that. He is training you as sons by allowing you to go through some tough things here on earth. Look in the book of Deuteronomy, please. Deuteronomy chapter 8. God has used that language before. Deuteronomy chapter 8. This is when Moses is speaking to the Israelites before they enter the promised land. And notice what he says. Again, framing things in their mind for them. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2. "You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds from the mouth of God, mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you." Notice the phrasing, "was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son." What's he telling these Israelites after 40 years out in the wilderness? God was disciplining you. Yeah, sometimes he let you be hungry. He let you endure a number of hardships. Why was he doing that? Well, to teach you some lessons here. He mentions that you learn to trust in the Lord. What comes out of the mouth of the Lord, he's disciplining, just like a father would his children. Look in the book of Job again, this time chapter 42, please. Job 42, look at the conclusion of the matter. And notice the wording that's used here. Now, this is not one of the crazy friends talking. This is the inspired narrator here in chapter 42, Job 42 and verse 11. "Then all his brothers and all his sisters and all who had known him before came to him, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversities that the Lord had brought on him." That the Lord had brought on him. That's the way the inspired narrator is told to phrase that there. And that is, as we know from chapters 1 and 2, not that God directly was doing this to Job. That's the assumption the friends made. But the Bible sometimes word things like that. When God allows something or somebody else allows something, it's said that they did it. And here it seems to be using it that way, Job 42:11. The Lord allowed Satan to do this, and so it says the adversities that the Lord brought on him. Now, back to our text, please. Hebrews, let's actually start in chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10. Consider the context in Hebrews, starting all the way back here in chapter 10. So our passage in question is Hebrews 12:4-11. Okay, so I'm asking you to back up a page, Hebrews chapter 10, and in verse 32. But remember the former days when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. So he's writing to these people who are initially receiving this letter, and he's mentioning, you had to endure. You guys have been suffering. You know what I'm talking about. You have suffered, verse 33, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. He goes on talking about those things. The point is that they had endured suffering. And in verse 39, he says, but we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. Okay, so these people were suffering, but they're being encouraged. Endure. I know you've suffered, but we're not the kind of people that just shrink back. Okay, endure, endure, keep going. And then what's chapter 11 about? I mean, it's all these men and women of faith, right? And he's encouraging them. Again, here's examples for you. All these men and women from past centuries who have gone on to do great things because of their faith. They endured through whatever it was the circumstances were in their life, and they endured because they were trusting in God. Hebrews 11 and verse 6, without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. And so example after example in chapter 11, they show you that if you seek God, everything is going to turn out well in the end. Maybe not in this life, but certainly in eternity. If you have to endure tragedies, if you have to endure hardships, if you have to endure even death, hang in there. Be faithful to God. Look at verse 36, Hebrews 11:36. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. That's who he's talking about. And then we get to chapter 12, and chapter 12 drives home the point. Look at chapter 12 and verse 1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. Notice the word endurance there. He's going to keep repeating that. So keep enduring. He's talking to these people that the book of Hebrews is initially written to. Stand fast. Be faithful. Endure. I know you're going through rough stuff. Endure. In fact, God's own son is the perfect example of having to endure hardships. And so he says in verse 2, Hebrews 12:2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. So Jesus is the example that we can look to for strength. And again, notice that word endure he keeps using. Jesus made the ultimate sacrifice. Jesus gave up his life. He allowed himself to be murdered. And he says to these people, you guys haven't been murdered yet. Verse 4, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, and you're striving against sin. But even if it came to that, the point is that even if it came to that, Jesus has already set that example too. He's already gone to that extreme. And so you can follow Jesus' example in that as well. And so that's the context leading up to our passage, which starts in Hebrews 12 and verse 4. God was not punishing them. Don't take the word discipline to mean punish. God was not punishing them, but he was certainly allowing them to endure hardships that would mature their faith, like a father disciplines his son. Look in Acts 14. Hold your place here. Look in Acts 14. Verses 21 and 22. I think there's a little bit of a parallel here when Paul is going back and strengthening these folks. Acts 14 and verse 21, after they had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith and saying, through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. Through many tribulations. So Paul's word, Paul's coming back, he's encouraging them, he's teaching them. His word certainly encouraged them, but also the tribulations that they were going through helped to strengthen their faith. So both things were had, Paul's words and enduring those tribulations. Earthly fathers, don't we do the same thing? kind of a twofold approach. Our words to our sons and daughters, certainly, but also we let them go through some things. We let them get toughened by the circumstances of life. So we're not just talking to them. We're allowing them to go through some tough things so that they can learn. And I'm suggesting for your study and consideration the same interpretation of what we have in Hebrews chapter 12, 4 through 11, that both the letter and the trials of life combine to form God's fatherly discipline of what he's blessing them with and getting them in this situation where their faith is going to end up being matured. See what you think about that. So if that's the case, what are the benefits of enduring hardships in this life? What are the benefits of this fatherly discipline? First of all, it builds character. Look again in Hebrews 12 and verse 10. Hebrews 12 and verse 10. For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful, yet to those who've been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. That is, God's discipline allows us to become holy, verse 10, righteous, verse 11. Turn forward another page, James chapter 1 and verse 2. Even if I'm all mixed up on what Hebrews 12 is talking about, we get the same lesson in these other passages clearly. James 1 and verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, trials are hard. If it wasn't hard, it wouldn't be called a trial. But he's talking about trials here, and he's saying, when you encounter various trials, you need to have joy, not in the trial itself, but in the knowledge that that trial produces these better things, this endurance and so forth. And so God gives us a new perspective there. We find joy in that knowledge. Go forward a few more pages. 1 Peter chapter 1. And 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter is another letter written to these people, and like most Christians in the first century, they're having to endure tough things, persecution and bad circumstances. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. So what does that tell you about the people he's writing to? Apparently they've been distressed by various trials. Verse 7, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, I like that phrase, tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you rejoice greatly with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. And so these people were being tested by fire, figuratively speaking, but that served to deepen their spirituality, refined, and it purified their faith. They weren't just going to church because they're bored or to socialize with folks or something like that. You don't risk your life for those things. But if you understand the importance of serving King Jesus, if you understand the importance of your eternal soul, you'll endure anything. You'll be killed if it comes to that for the sake of your soul. And he's writing these words to these people to encourage them. Look in chapter 4, 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. So again, you say, well, why is God allowing? Here's God's people. Why is God allowing them to be tested by fire, to go through whatever it is these verses are talking about, that these people specifically were going through? Well, so that they would be tested. Just like recruits are sent through army boot camp, and that toughens them and purifies them and strengthens them, Christians endure trials to prove their faith. Look in Romans chapter 5, please. Romans chapter 5. And in verse 3, Romans 5 and verse 3, and not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. So all of this builds character. So what does that mean in my life? Well, first of all, I have to realize that being a Christian does not mean that God is just going to smooth everything out in my life. He's going to remove all the problems of my life. I'm just going to have a nice, easy existence from this time forward. In fact, these passages teach the opposite of that. Secondly, I have to interpret the hardships of my life as opportunities to grow. I can and should certainly pray to God. And we don't know what God's going to do. We know that He wants us to pray. He wants us to bring our anxieties, our problems to Him. And God may intervene and God may help us with something. God, that's always an option. We ought to be praying, and that's certainly there. But in the meantime, He teaches me to endure and grow. That might be the answer to prayer. No, I'm going to let this one happen because you need to grow through this. And I need to understand that. That's a biblical theme. All through these passages we've been reading, I'll be a stronger, tougher, more faithful person because of what I go through, because of what my Father is allowing me to go through. It's His fatherly love and discipline. Also, it develops my sympathy and service for others. Look back at Hebrews chapter 10, please. Notice the words, we read them already, but notice especially the words used here. Hebrews 10, 32 to 34, when he says, "But remember the former days when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by," notice the last phrase of verse 33, "partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one." Okay, so notice the word sharers there in verse 33. Your translation might say companions or partners or something like that. That's the word that can also be translated as fellowship. We might have certain things pop in our minds with the word fellowship, but the way it's being used here, fellowship just means joint participation. What this is talking about in this context is joint participation in suffering. You're sharing in that suffering. You're a joint participant in that suffering here. And so that goes along with the sympathy there in verse 34. You showed sympathy to the prisoners, or your translation might say suffered alongside. Doesn't necessarily mean that they were also in prison, but it felt like it, emotionally and relationally, that they were so sympathetic to other brethren who'd been thrown in prison that it felt like they were in prison also because of that sympathy. By the way, same word, that word sympathy, the Greek word, go back a couple of pages, Hebrews 4:15. Same word is used in Hebrews 4:15 in reference to Jesus. Hebrews 4:15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who's been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin." Same word there. Jesus not only knows what we're going through because He's deity and He knows everything anyway, but He's been here and done that. He went through it as a human. He lived on this earth in the flesh and lived it. And so when I suffer the hardships of life, it puts me in a position to sympathize in a unique way with others who are also going through that, to comfort, to encourage, to help others when they are suffering. For example, maybe a younger Christian is getting into middle school, high school, and they're fighting the battle that we all fight. What kind of clothes am I going to wear? Modest, immodest, whatever. And so they are starting to avoid certain things. We don't want to dress like that. We're not going to go that direction. And because of that, maybe there's a social cost. Maybe they get made fun of. Maybe they're not part of this group. They're not as trendy, whatever, not as popular. Who can sympathize with them? All the older Christians who've been there, done that, who fought that fight, said, "I remember what it was like," and this and that, and we can talk with them and sympathize. We're in a good position to encourage them and say, "Hang in there. You're doing the right thing. You're making the right decision. It's worth it." Maybe someone's lost a baby. Maybe someone's lost a spouse or some other loved one. Who can sympathize with that unique pain? Somebody who's been through it, who's felt that kind of grief. Maybe somebody has had to give up a job for some sort of spiritual reason. Maybe they took a pay cut, but they just said, "I just got to do this. For my walk with God, for time with my family," just who can sympathize with that transition? Somebody who's also done the same thing. Someone who can come up and put their arm around them and say, "Man, I've been there. I had to do that a few years ago. And I know how hard it is. I know it's hard to make the finances work. I know what you're going through. I know how tough that decision probably was. But I'll tell you, it paid huge dividends in my family. My walk with God, my walk with my spouse, my kids, it was worth it. Hang in there." And so hardships help me do that, help me sympathize with others and serve others who are later going through similar things. And number three, makes me look forward to heaven. Look again in Hebrews chapter 10, please, verse 34. Hebrews 10, 34, "For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised." How can you endure suffering with joy? Well, you got to have the mindset, this isn't my home anyway. I'm just a pilgrim. I'm passing through. My hope is not here. In Hebrews 11, when he's talking about all those great men and women of faith, same deal. Notice in verse 10, this is when he's talking about Abraham, Hebrews 11 and verse 10, "For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." How can you be content? Abraham had to live in tents all those years. How can you be content living a life like that? I'd like to settle down, you know, and have a place. Well, Abraham said, well, it's not my home anyway, you know. I'm looking for the eternal rest. Hebrews 11 and verse 13, "All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they have been thinking of that country from which they went out, they could have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." And so if my hope is tied up in this world, I will be crushed when inevitably hardships come. At some point, things in my life will fail. Everything I have in this world, these physical things, it's all coming to an end. One way or the other, it's going to fail, it's going to end. My money, my relationships, my job, my body, my house, my hobby, my car, everything. It has an end point. It's not eternal. None of that will last forever. And so when these hardships come along, it helps to wean me off of the world. And it serves as a reminder, sometimes a pretty severe reminder. This is not home. I can't count on this world. And it forces me to realize the world's fading away. I need something else to look forward to, just like Abraham and the others in Hebrews 11. Malcolm Muggeridge wrote about affliction in his book, A 20th Century Testimony. He said, "Contrary to what might be expected, I look back on experiences at the time that seemed desolating and painful with particular satisfaction. Indeed, I can say with complete truthfulness that everything I have learned in my 75 years in this world, everything that has truly enhanced and enlightened my existence has been through affliction and not through happiness." So consider that maybe that's included in what Hebrews 12 is talking about. He disciplines us for our good. That is, God allows us to suffer and struggle in this world so that we'll be drawn more and more toward him, to realize I need something else besides this world. We want you to have that hope. The hope of having an existence without sorrow, pain, and loss. We want you to have that fellowship with him. To endure with the rest of us this fatherly discipline. To get us ready for eternity. We want you to be baptized into Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. Acts 2:38. We want you to be walking in newness of life, Romans 6, 3 and 4, so that you have that hope, that peace, and that joy. Love to sit and study those things with you. If you're ready to do that now, we're ready to baptize you now. If we can help you in a public way, please come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.